G'day and welcome to the Mountain Cat Guitars podcast, where we discuss all things guitar related. My name is Doug Meyer, owner of Mountain Cat Guitars, and I've been buying and selling guitars professionally for over 25 years. From boutique guitar and amp builders, vintage guitar dealers and experts, guitar repairmen and luthiers, retailers, manufacturers, and of course guitar players, we talk to the people who buy, sell, play, and of course obsess over the things we love most, guitars.
Take one.
Hi, this is Doug Meyer from Mountain Cat Guitars, and welcome to Mountain Cat Guitars podcast number 4. And we are very happy today to have my old friend Bob Chakowski, better known as Night Bob, with us today. Came up on the train from New York City, and we're very happy to have him here in the lounge in Suffern, New York.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. And I've known Night Bob for quite a while. It's funny, I remember the day I met you, actually.
Really?
Yeah, I was at Chelsea Guitars.
Good place.
And you came in, I was like the new guy, and you came in and you said, I want to consign a guitar, and I was like, cool. And it was a Star guitar.
Oh, right, the one that was done on a spin painting thing. Yeah, I remember that.
I don't know if you can remember the exact
I remember that. I bought that on eBay for like $100.
It was cool.
It was cool, you know, but it was like, you know, it's like one of those things, like, you know, like, buyer's regret, you know. It's like, oh, fuck, I'm never going to play this.
Yeah, I remember. Yeah. I was like, all right, this is cool. And then we started talking, and you were super cool. And I was like, oh, this guy's awesome. And someone already told me who you were, so I knew roughly who you were. And then Danny came in later that day, Danny, the fellow who owns Chelsea Guitars, and he looked at it, and he's like, the fuck is that? And I was like, oh, that's like, I consigned it. And he's like, why? Why would you consign it? I was like,
oh, you sold it.
Night Bob. Oh, he's like, oh, it's Night Bob. Oh, great, you know? So that's when I originally met you at Chelsea Guitars.
That was back in the day of Big Chelsea.
Right. And that's where everyone hung out.
Yeah, no, you know, it was a spot.
Yeah, that was the coolest part of
working.
People
I met there I still talk to.
Yeah, people met their girlfriends there, bands formed.
People,
there.
You know, people launched their careers there too, you know.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of guys who worked for Dan who also went on to bigger and better things.
Were there?
Yeah, well, so you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah, because, you know, like, well, there weren't too many people before me, but, you know, John Teagle worked there before I did.
Right, that's what I mean.
Sullivan worked there before I did.
Right, you know, you had a bunch of good repairmen.
Yeah, Bobby Ross.
Right, Craig.
You know, Craig, yeah, who still is.
Then you had, what's
Eric
his name?
Klosted.
Eric Klosted. Who's the guy who's making guitars in Brooklyn?
Who worked at Chelsea? Oh, Matt Rubendahl.
Right, the other one. With the big headstocks.
Oh, Cobra.
Cobra. That's, I'm sorry. This is what's wrong with being old. You know, it's like,
I forgot about Cobra. Oh, yeah. We discovered Cobra. Danny discovered Cobra.
Uh-huh. He's still doing it.
Yeah, he's great. I'm trying to get him on the podcast next month.
Oh, you should get him.
Yeah, very interesting fellow. Really, he has a place out in Brooklyn called The Shop with Moschino? And Eric from Labella Strings.
Right.
Which
Moss
is
cool another off-the-radar.
Serious guy.
Serious builder.
Yeah, great fellow.
Great guy.
Yeah, those guys. Well, that was all started at Cobra Guitars, which turned into now the guitar shop, which is Carbonetti Guitars, which is which is Cobra's real name,
right.
James Carbonetti.
Right.
And he's still with Moss and Eric from LaBelle, and they have a hip spot out there in Sunset Park.
Good for them. You know, I mean, it's like I encourage all small builders.
Right. Well, that's really the thing, and that's why with this podcast, because you've been on other podcasts, and a lot of people know you as a front house sound man for
tour manager,
all sorts of huge bands, and a tour
manager
and that stuff, a touring guy. But most people don't know about your association with guitar
companies.
And obviously, you must be, you know, you obviously started as a guitar player, I assume. And that's how you got into this. So when did you start playing guitar?
Here's an interesting fact, right? When I was a little kid, maybe about 12 years old, I had a sister who was a year younger, and my parents were super musical. They didn't play. But the house was always filled with music.
You hear that a lot from people your age.
Yeah, like, well, it's also...
My parents didn't play, but they always had music.
They were like second generation from, moving from, immigrating to America, right? Hot topic, right? And but there was all kinds of music. When I grew up, I was like, what do you mean? You know, I mean, like Chuck Berry was played in my house, as was, you know, Patsy Cline, as was Ray Charles.
People were all around it back then. They would listen
to pulp
music,
you know,
they'd listen to Otis Redding. You know?
My mom was into country music. My dad was a jazz guy, big band guy, They all understood music. So the thing was, I don't know whether they read it or, you know, How to Raise Your Kids Right or something, but they came to me and my sister and they said, we want you guys to pick a musical instrument and put a year in. After a year, you can stop. And if you want to pursue it, that's great. If you don't, that's fine. But you need to put a year
in.
That's
very cool.
And then what they did was they sat us down in front of the TV and they let us watch Lawrence Welk because all the instruments
were there.
Are there. Right. And everybody gets a little solo,
wow.
Right? Interesting, right? And my dad, he wanted me to play sax really bad. He wanted me to, be a jazz guy,
yeah.
And so he's going, you really check out the sax player, right? And so we're looking and watch the whole show. And at the end, my sister goes, piano. So they go, all right, we're going to get you a piano, right? And they turn to me and I go, guitar. And my dad goes, why guitar?
Yes, the worst instrument.
I got to tell you, Dad, I looked at those horn players and they all looked really unhappy playing. They're always like,
you got to breathe all the time.
I go, this guy, Buddy Merrill, he would stand up and he had the coolest looking guitar ever. He had the Stratocaster with a gold pickguard, yeah. Maple neck. He's up there, he's smiling away, rocking out. And I go, that's what I want.
That's interesting. I never did that. That's really interesting that your parents did that.
Yeah, very interesting.
Do you think they came up with that on their own? Or that
no,
was
I think they read it somewhere somehow.
Every house had a piano back then.
There was music,
yeah.
What I mean? It's like
my grandparents always had a piano. My grandmother played the piano.
My mom worked for RCA making tubes, right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's
Harrison, New Jersey, right?
Wow.
She's, it was really interesting because at first we said, hey, can you bring us home some tubes? And she was like, why? And I go, because they look like 50s robots, right? So she'd bring the duds home. We have a good time throwing them out the window, put them in rocket ships, set them on fire, so we always had an RCA stereo, usually like a console stereo,
wow.
tube stereo, big TV, yeah. Record player, lift the lid, put the records on,
That's dope.
You used to have to always fight to get turntable time.
Right.
And then they gave me my own portable RCA record player because
wow.
They were like, you're playing really some weird shit.
Yeah, we don't want to hear it.
You go down to the basement and play that Rolling Stone music.
Well,
it was like the Rolling Stones. My father goes like, nah, this is okay, but
yeah.
He goes, you really should get a Howlin' Wolf or a Muddy Waters record. In fact,
wow,
seriously. And he goes, I'll show you where the roots are. That shit comes
wow.
from here.
Wow, so you really knew music.
Well, let's just say that it was, it's imprinted on you a little
right.
bit,
that's
that it's like, okay.
So we had to find it ourselves. Like, I was from the generation, my sister brought it all home.
So
my
had...
My father liked Jethro Tull. Like, he
wasn't
that, he liked the Beach Boys when he was young.
Of course.
And, he was always into music, though. He was always playing music. His thing was, top 40. He liked whatever records were current. He liked, hit songs.
My dad really liked Chuck Berry, mainly because of the lyrical content.
Yeah.
Right. He said that it really summed up his teenage years
right.
and everybody because it was so. It was like
it was rock and roll.
You listen to Sweet Little 16 in Memphis or Johnny Be Good.
Yeah.
It tells a story.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
he was the best.
And it was funny. Was the first thing, I got a guitar teacher and he was really terrible. I mean, whenever I made a mistake, he would hit my finger with a pencil.
Yeah, you could hear that shit from back then too.
Yeah, so I went to my father and said, this guy, he hits me. He goes, what do you mean he hits you?
Yeah, people were weird back then.
So he was gone, right? Then he got me a jazz guitar player as a teacher who was really great. His name was Barry. I can't remember his last name. He was from Northern Jersey. He was really cool. He was like the first really kind of mentor guy. He was also the first guy I ever saw who could, I want to play this song, right? I wanted to play Rumble by Link Wray,
right?
And he would go, play it for me. And he'd listen to it, then he'd write it out,
wow.
Right? And then, and then say, okay, read this, right? I thought it was magic. I go, how do you do that?
Yeah,
you just pulled it out of the air.
That's when you first start seeing that.
You go like,
people are so formative. When you first start playing guitar, everything imprints on you. Everything everyone says.
Oh, absolutely.
You go to a guitar shop and you overhear some guy, because there was no other way to get information.
Well, information's a good point that I want to get to, right? Like when at first it was like, I picked guitar. And then my father said, now you need to do the research. You got to find out what kind of guitar you need.
Okay.
I'm like, okay. So he gave me a copy of Downbeat magazine, right?
Wow.
And he said, there's coupons. You can send to every guitar maker and ask them questions and ask them to send you a catalog.
Wow.
And I was like, that's
okay.
A great idea, So it's like, I'd write a little letter saying,
like,
hi.
To be a guitar player someday.
I want to buy a Rickenbacker. I want to buy a Fender. I need to know. And they would send me catalogs.
That's cool.
And they would send, sometimes you get a letter back. My favorite two of all time were like F.C. Hall from Rickenbacker, who wrote me, he wrote me a really nice letter encouraging me to pursue the guitar and then sent me a 1957 catalog.
Wow.
Because I was like, I don't see any of these guitars in the stores.
Right.
You know, it's like, whatever, right? And the other good one was Ampeg that sent me a really nice letter because they were in Linden,
right.
You know, New Jersey. And they so you know, I said I saw the Vanilla Fudge and they had an Ampeg amplifier and I thought it was the greatest. So they were really nice. They were really glad you enjoyed the Vanilla Fudge. You know, here's a nice Ampeg catalog.
What year was that?
I had to be 68.
Right, so shit was really popping at that.
Yeah, it was starting to really bang up,
yeah.
You know, 67, 68, you know. And I didn't know you could, I didn't know catalogs existed, really.
Yeah, well, that, you don't still have them, do you?
Yes, I do. I have the Ampeg layer, and I have the Rickenbacker layer.
That's cool.
Right, and it started this quest for information.
Right.
Right, so I had everybody's catalogs, right? And then you learn, you know? You know how it is. You sit there, you don't have it, but you, it's like
right.
It's like the Lionel Train catalog.
Yeah, I want that!
You know,
from maybe 10 years later, but there still wasn't much information. You'd go to, like the mall and go to the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like a book or two on guitars. It was like
the were lucky to have a book,
right? The Ian Bishop book on Gibson guitars,
that
orange one. I still have it.
Yeah, you know, those. You know, it was funny because Tom Wheeler just passed away a couple of days ago, right? And he wrote the book,
the Mickey. Yeah,
the first real,
the first real guitar book. Everybody
real guitar book, right? And I remember I took the bus and the train into New York, and I had to go find it. I had to go in. You know, it was a tough find, right? But
you used to go to whatever the big chain was. What was the big bookstore?
Yeah, we actually
then. And they had a music section. Like you could buy a book on Led Zeppelin.
Kresge's,
we had
department store.
What it was, and like it was in the old.
I went to the publisher. I went right to the source.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I went to actually to Thomas Organ that was on 42nd Street.
That's right. You wouldn't go into the city that
to get a box catalog.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. I thought that I'd go there and they'd all be there, and it was like a Super Beetle, and that was it, and a bunch of organs. They gave me a catalog.
We got a little older. We would like take the bus into New York City, and go to 48th Street.
Then
we would just be like, "Whoa!" So we'd stand in front of Richie Friedman's window, and after a while, he would come out and go like, "You guys got to get out of here.
Yeah.
You're putting fingerprints all over my window." We'd just be like, "What do you mean? We're just looking at these guitars." And then we'd go to another store, but we'd always wind up back in Richie Friedman's window because there was just like a line of Les Pauls. You'd be like,
"It was all this stuff."
But he wouldn't really talk to us.
Wow.
Why should he? We didn't have any money.
There was a snotty attitude on
48.
Let me explain to that.
Right? I love him like a brother.
I'm a bit older than you, so it's like, you know, I'm sitting in New Jersey, right, and I'm reading Hit Parader because they had a lot of ads.
Right.
More ads than
anything else.
More ads than Downbeat, right? And I'm flipping through there, and they're talking about the Yardbirds, and you know, or something. And they go like, "Yeah, all the British bands buy their gear from this place, Manny's, on West 48th Street." And I turned to my pal who I played in a little surf rock band. I go, "We gotta go," you know. So we took same thing. Took the bus in to 42nd Street. Walked down the Deuce. Yeah. You know, I was like, "Whoa, this is scary."
You turn that corner, and all of a sudden your heart starts going.
Then you come around the corner.
Start seeing guitar shops. You're like, "Whoa!"
And this was the old Manny's, the smaller Manny's, where when you went, it was very narrow. Not the big Manny's. There was.
I don't know if I ever saw the smaller.
It was a much smaller Manny's.
Different location.
Closer to 7th
Avenue. Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, I got to show you some pairs.
So when Hendrix bought his guitars, it wasn't in the place that I was going to?
Probably not. It was really narrow.
I never knew there was a different place.
And you would go in, and it was all band instruments, you know, brass.
Yeah,
and you'd walk through it. Well, it was kind of like that. And then you'd go down 5 steps in the back, and that's where all the guitars and amps were.
It was different when I would go. You know, you walked right in those guitars. I think it was drums upstairs.
No, this is like...
Yes, it was different Manny's.
It had to be... It was on the block. It was Manny's. I'll send you a picture I have of like the young rascal standing in front of the old man's, right? And then up there it says in the second floor it says, "We are the official distributor for Vox, Mosrite, Rickenbacker," you know, and all, you know, big sign, right? There was no Sam Ash at that point in Manhattan. There was Jimmy's Guitars that was there too. That's the first time I ever saw a Marshall Stack.
It was the late 60s, right?
Yeah. It was first, you know, it was like Manny's didn't have them. at that point. Jimmy's did, though.
Why weren't there many in the States, even?
Listen, they had pinstripe, you know, Marshall stack with pinstripe cloth.
Whoa.
And I remember going in there and going, like, and just reaching and touching it.
Yeah.
And I got, this grill cloth is rubbery. Because it was, you know, it was seat material.
Right? Yeah.
So we were like, wow. And Dan Armstrong had a place around the corner. I mean, it was like the infancy, you know.
Yeah, I didn't get to see because I didn't start going there, I guess, till it would have been the 80s, you know, 80 or 81 by the time we started getting on
the
bus.
The joy of being old,
drive,
you know,
yet. Right.
You get
yeah,
to
I mean, I came right behind all you guys. Right. So, like, I didn't get to see shows at the Fillmore. And you guys got to see all those shows.
Yeah.
Like, everyone saw the Allman Brothers at the Fillmore. You know, I didn't get to see that.
Right. So that was a little further on. An interesting point that impacts me is that, you know, like my dad said, do the research, right? And then we went down to, I want a Stratocaster really bad,
right?
He made me mow lawns and do, you know, take paper to the junkyard and all this kind of shit all summer. So I had like $125, right? And so we went down to this music store in Newark, New Jersey, right? Unfortunately, we went to the wrong one. Went to this place, Music City, right? Actually, it wasn't the wrong one when you really think about it. And I wanted to buy a Stratocaster and they said $200. So I didn't have enough money, right? So my father, you know, goes like, do you have anything that has been, you know, a used guitar? And they go, yeah, we have this Gibson guitar you can have for, you know, that's used, much more affordable. And he turns to me, he goes, that's a real guitar, a Gibson.
Wow.
He goes, that Fender guitar...
So
made
much.
In California, you know, it's like, whatever, you know,
weirdos
it's like Gibson's been around. Only a Gibson is good enough. That's what the jazz guys say. So they bring out a blonde ES-225, two P90s, right, wraparound tailpiece, right, and in really good condition. And my old man goes, how much? And they go, 150. He goes, that's used, right? And they go, okay, $100. He was a Navy guy. He was, you know, so he knew how to strike a deal.
$100, good deal.
So I get this guitar for $100, right? And I was still like, yeah, I got a guitar now. I really wish I got that Strat, you know. But, you know.
Yeah, that's, you know. When you
but I learned to play on that guitar, which I still have.
That's cool. That was the next question. Where's that guitar?
I have it.
That's
sitting
cool.
Sitting at home.
Managed
first guitar,
keep it all those years.
First guitar I ever modded. You know, I put a Bigsby on it. I put Grover tuners. You know?
At least you humbucker it, right?
No, I didn't humbucker it. No.
That's usually what came next. You know, like,
I had to stuff it full of T-shirts to stop it from
beating back. I did that, too.
Back.
Put socks in it. We
I put T-shirts.
About one of them, like, yeah, because they said Ted Nugent. Socks
yeah,
and his guitars.
Yeah.
He probably didn't, but someone told us that.
You know what? That's an interesting point. You know,
but you were into that, did you think?
Well, yeah, but I mean, like in the pre-internet age, right? Getting any kind of information,
it was
very difficult. There was a lot of, you know, people would. These rumors
you'd say
would go around.
Like, yeah.
Ted Nugent stuffed his guitars
with
socks. Yeah,
it was like Donald Duck Dunn puts barbecue sauce on his strings.
Yep. My favorite one was. We went to see Cactus at the Fillmore. Everybody go, oh my God, Jim McCarty has the greatest guitar tone, right? And like the rumor was, this is how McCarty has this great tone. He had his pickups rewound with platinum wire, right? And we're like,
ooh,
that's expensive.
That sounds awesome.
Wait, and that behind his Marshall stack, he plugged into a Tweed Deluxe. And then took the speaker output and plugged that into his Marshall, which may have been true.
Well, Clapton was doing that.
Yeah, people did that.
With
you know?
Tweed, with champs, because they loved the sound of a champ,
right?
But you couldn't get a big one. So they said they were doing that with like, bass, you know, Fender Bandmaster heads going into on like, the Delaney and Bonnie tours, you know, shit like that. Like
right.
It wasn't happening at Cream.
But you know, that's the way information was passed around.
Right, and whether it was true or not didn't matter.
Didn't matter.
You know, like that's.
You know? Because you were still searching.
Right, or you just hang out in a guitar shop and you hear something, or someone would tell you, oh, you know, Hendrix did this.
So the important part of the first guitar story is used guitars are good and how to negotiate a deal.
Right.
Because when I was growing up, it was the golden age. Nothing was vintage. Everything was used.
Used guitars,
you go
right.
like my... I was desperate to get a Stratocaster, right?
And me too. That was my first, like, real guitar. My first guitar
great.
Was, like, a Les Paul copy of some sort.
Yeah.
And I really wanted a Stratocaster, and I had the first Clapton solo record. We're sitting on a chair, and there's a brown Stratocaster.
Yep.
You know, so, like, I would stare at it and be like, I want a Stratocaster. And it was the same thing. All summer, I worked, and I did whatever stupid shit. And my sister gave me some money towards it, and then my father told me to pay for the rest if I did something, and I did it. So it comes time to go buy the guitar, and I call every guitar shop in the tri-state area. It was 1979. Uh-huh. So I'm like, look, do you have a Sunburst Stratocaster? And like, no one's got them. Right. I didn't know. I didn't know. So finally, someone says yes, and it's Victor's House of Music in Ridgefield.
Oh yeah,
old one.
Yeah.
So because then it moved in and turned into a guitar center. So mm-hmm. and I couldn't drive. I was a kid, so I had to get my father to drive me, like, you know, on a Saturday. So that whole week, you're like, I had to cut school. I couldn't even sit there. Stratocaster. I'm gonna sleep with it. I wanted to play it in the car on the way home. I had it all planned.
Oh, like, of course.
Walk into the store, and I got the Clapton record with me. And I'm like, hi, called about the thing. And they bring out a Sienna Sunburst, big headstock
Strat. Of course, yeah.
And I was like, I kind of wanted this. Uh-huh. You know, and they're like,
they don't make that.
That's a 50s Strat. Yeah, they don't
that's old.
That anymore.
That's you know? No good.
They said, this is the Sunburst they make now, and this headstock has been this way for a long time. It's not the same thing.
Uh-huh.
But I think I'd seen the big headstocks, because I saw Richie Blackmore, so I knew there were big headstocks. But I didn't know there were only big headstocks. You know, you didn't think. I was like,
there wasn't that information.
And
there really wasn't.
I'll take it. You know, like,
yeah. Well.
And I took it home, and it, like, I slept with it the first night.
I got to say that when I bought my first new guitar, right, I had it next to my bed,
mm-hmm.
and I would get up in the middle of the night, and I'd open up the case and look at it, like, oh.
Right, see, regular people can't understand
that. No, it's a fixation.
You did what?
It's a fixation.
That's why we want to do a podcast later. Right. It'll blow a bunch of things, but on just the sickest things you've done or craziest things people have done to get guitars or even that. Like, I remember when I bought my first real Tele from Rogue Music. I bought it from Ed Sullivan.
Uh-huh.
When I first moved to New York City, like, I bought a 60s parts Tele. I was so into it. And literally, I would do that. I would leave it on the stand next to my bed, and I kept waking up and just looking at it. And you go back to sleep so happy. Mm-hmm. You know?
Well, I've been cured of that, you know. But
sometimes.
I'll tell you a funny story, right? I got a job, right? Actually working like part-time at the post office, which was a trial program, right? So I was making some good money, right? After school, you work 4 hours in the post office, boom, you know, so you'd be home by 10, right? So you're making some decent cash, right? So I'm living at home, don't have much of an overhead, right? I got some money, right? And then this pal I was playing in a band with says, you know, you're always lusting after a Strat, you know? I go, yeah. He goes, well, you know, Jimmy, you know, on the other, down the block, he's got a Strat. He goes, he wants to sell it. And I'm like, going over there with a pocket full of money. You know, it's just like, oh, Jimmy, I hear you got this guitar. $150, I'll give you $100 right now. Right, he goes, sold! I'm like, my Strat.
Yeah.
Said, get ready for this. It's a 60 Strat, it's black. Slabby board, right?
Whoa.
I got my Strat, right? I'm there. I'm the happiest guy on the planet, right? I got it for, you know, like $100. Same as I paid for the Gibson, right? So I'm like on top of the world. About 2 months later, at this point, Guitar Player magazine is being printed.
When did that start?
Late 60s.
Oh, did it really?
Yeah, late 60s, 67,
oh, yeah,
68.
Had to. You see those old early 70s
right.
Things.
So
on the
here,
cover.
This is, you know, so I get this magazine, and it's got Jerry Garcia on the cover, right? And he's got a maple neck Strat with a stripped finish, right?
It's
ash body.
Right.
Right? I'm like, oh, that looks great.
Oh, no.
Oh, you know what's coming. That looks great. So I go with my father. I go, how do I get the paint off this guitar? Right? He goes, go get zip strip.
Zip strip. We all did
You all did zip. So, you know, it's like I had a Phillips screwdriver. You can take all the parts off. Not a big deal, right?
Oh, no.
So I'm down in the basement, right? And I'm using this stuff, right?
It's like, super toxic.
And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, oh, ooh, I'm feeling pretty dizzy. And I go, hey, this stuff's making me dizzy. He goes, take it out.
Side. You're
going to
blow up the house.
So I have like one of those paint scrapers, and I'm scraping off the black, right?
No.
Underneath the black is seafoam green, right? And I'm like, that's worse. You know, it's like, I'm like, oh, I can't be seen with a green guitar. More zip strip, right? Right? So what happens is I get down to bare wood. It's alder. Right, I didn't know that. I thought every guitar had grain like that.
Right.
This is a big aha moment,
yeah, like,
right?
Oh,
where it's like,
shit.
Now I have a brown guitar with with no finish.
Oh no!
Right?
And you stripped two custom colors off of it.
Right, and I'm like, oh shit! I should have left it black. You know, and then it was funny because someone says to me, he goes, I heard you have
an old Strat.
And I go, yeah, I do. He goes, I'm looking for an old Strat. So I sold it to this guy for $175.
Whoa!
Right? So at this point, I begin to understand the wheeling and dealing of guitars.
Right.
Right. And like, you know, he who holds the cash controls the deal,
right.
You know, so that was pretty interesting.
You start to learn that.
And then you also, you know, like when I got my driver's license, we're going like, let's see what else is around here. So we would drive around, you know, as far down south as like Asbury Park, you know, we just get the Yellow Pages out, find out where the music stores are. What do you got that's used?
Right.
Right. And we buy stuff. I mean, I honestly went to Robbie's Music in Newark. And I was looking around, there was a Les Paul Jr., right? And I said, how much? And they go, $75. I go, let me go home and get the money. Another important point, always have money, right? So I had to take the bus, you know, because I didn't want to drive into Newark because it was touchy times in the 60s.
Yeah, that's right? So weird.
And so I take the bus down, you know, of course, you know, you didn't have to park. So I went home, got the money, came back, I go in there and I go, I'm here to get the amp. I get the guitar. He pulls up the guitar and he goes, $125. I go, wait a minute, you said 75. And he goes, because it comes with an amp, right? And then he pulls up this Tweed Deluxe.
Oh, no.
Right? So I'm like, here's the 75. Right. I'll be right back. You know, I got to take the bus back to the bank, get some more money, right? And then come back. And then I had like a Les Paul Jr., like Leslie West, and some dumb tweed amp, you know, that I traded for, I don't know.
Something else. Yeah.
You know, a wah-wah pedal in a plus bass or something like that.
So then from there, so I assume you played in bands.
Well, I played in a lot of bands. Yep.
Before you started. So when you started sort of in the music business, you started really how?
A friend of mine, Harry Popick, who went on to work for the Grateful Dead. Right, he was their monitor engineer for like 100,000.
Oh, he was
years.
Like your mentor, right?
Yeah, you know, we started working for bands,
right?
Because I owned a PA,
right?
And for my band, right? Because my old man, he worked for the government in these like really designing missile guidance system. He worked on the lunar landing module stuff like that. He was big into this thing of like. I was like, I need a PA. We're gonna raise money and buy a PA. And he went, listen. He goes, just like you did with the guitars, write to the PA guys, right? So we write to JBL, Electro Voice,
right?
Altec Lansing.
PV.
And well, no, the PV didn't really exist then.
Came later,
But they said, hi, I'm in a band. I like your stuff. I can't afford it, and they said, then what you should do is we'll send you the plans. For speaker cabinets, and you can take it to into your high school wood shop, and have these made. Right?
Really?
I swear to God, yeah.
It's crazy that they would even do that.
They didn't care. They wanted to sell you speakers. They didn't care about the enclosures.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
we'll make the shit, we'll sell you a bunch.
I'll show you. You know some carpentry. You can make this. It's a box. You know, it's basically a box. Right. So.
Interesting.
So we had, you know, some pretty cool front-loaded 12-inch cabinets and these Electro Voice folded horn cabinets. We had a whacking PA. My father, where he worked, they used a lot of amplifiers for vibration testing.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And they were switching over to solid state. So he says to me,
"Give her those tube garbage."
He goes, "Listen, I'll tell you what's happening is they're throwing away all this
tube power amps,
right?" He goes. It'll be in a dumpster behind the building. When you get to the gate, tell them you come to see me.
Right.
And he goes, like, go right around the building and pull as many as you can, put them in your trunk, and then drive over to YM, and we'll hang out. Right. So, you know, boom. So I come home with 6 Macintosh tube power amps. Right. For nothing. So I had a pretty kick-ass PA.
Wow.
So I would rent that PA to this band, Black Forest Roads, right, who were... hip, super hip, played a lot more than my band did, you know. They broke into the college circuit and all that, because then back then it was the colleges were the best gigs,
because
they pay the best, or you try to get a summer residency down the shore, that kind of thing, right? So that's why I met Harry, and then over a period of time with doing these gigs, Harry says, listen, you know, he goes, I can get you a gig in New York City, where you'll run a rehearsal studio and your band will be able to rehearse there for free. And at that point, we'd gotten kind of loud and playing in my basement was like starting to go, you got to get out of here.
Yeah, Marshall's now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. You got to get out of here. We're trying to watch TV, you know. So he got me this gig and within, it was called Baggy Studios. Jimi Hendrix rehearsed a band of gypsies there at the end of the 60s. I started at the end of the summer of 72. The guy who ran the play, who owned the studio, was the Northeast rep for Sun.
Wow.
So everything was Sun.
It was Sun Amps.
Everything was Sun Amps. You know, they had rehearsal studio.
Fucking loud.
Sun PA, Sun bass amps. You know, a couple of Marshalls. Hey, they want the Marshalls, you know.
Yeah,
and everybody rehearsed there, from the New York Dolls to Mahavishnu Orchestra, the Stories to Peter Frampton. You know, wow. I mean, and there were two floors in there. So I was kind of a busy guy there. But I met all these people, you know, and you begin to realize that, you know, that, you know, I didn't know what I was. I basically had a PA that had like a volume and a tone control, you know. And like Harry gave me a quick run through. He goes, this shit's already like kind of dialed in. You just got to have like a good bedside manner.
Right, be nice,
you know,
to
I mean, I did 6 weeks of rehearsal with Johnny Winters, right? Where I'd sit at a monitor console in front of him, right? And
wow,
so I learned a lot, let me tell you. Learned a lot about Johnny Winter and a lot about professional, you know, how things work.
Right.
And I also began to realize that I was not as good a player as I thought
as
I was.
Johnny Winter, right?
Well, no, you sit there at Johnny Winter and go, he's really good, you know. And it's like,
really,
and I'll tell you a quick little side. At this point, I'll do this really quick, right? When I was in my little band, I was playing a 68 Les Paul that I had bought used, of course, for $200, right? And I was playing a gig in Jersey City, right? And one of the kids used to hang around at the band. They go, you know, over at that accordion store, they have a really funny looking Gibson guitar. I went, oh, funny looking Gibson, eh?
Oh,
so let's go.
Yeah.
So I walk in there, and there's hanging amongst the accordions is a 63 Firebird 3, right? And I go, oh, that's a horrible looking guitar. Well, why do you have that? He goes, this guy who traded it in on this Ampeg amp. I know, it's horrible. Make me an offer. I go, $60. And he goes,
done.
It's yours.
You still have it, right?
Right, yeah. And he goes, like, I go, you have a case, right? He goes, no. I go, do you expect me to take this thing home on a bus? Right, so he gave me a cello bag. Right, which I, you know, I was like, oh, now people think I'm a bad cello player, right? So I was, you know, so I had this guitar when I was, you know, doing these things with Johnny Winter. At one point, you know, I realized bedside manner, you know, get some communication going. So I said to Johnny during a break, I go, I have a guitar like that, and he goes, oh, you do?
Let me see it.
And he goes, you should bring it in so I can take a look at it, right? I'm like, okay. So I bring it in, right? He goes, this is a really nice guitar. You should, don't sell it. He said, but be really careful about the headstock. I go, yeah. I go, okay. He goes, and why are you carrying it in a cello bag? Right? And I go, that's all, the only thing that fits. And he goes, you know, I'm a touring musician. I use these big, heavy cases. He says, but I got a Firebird case, you know, or two or three, you know. Right. I'll bring a nice one in, and you can buy it from me. I go, cool, how much? He goes, $50. And I go, I'm going to pay $50. Yeah, bucks. I don't pay
$60.
I need a case.
Yeah, fuck
right?
it.
Still have that, too. Right? And at the same time he brought that in, Ed Selig, Silver Strings Music from St. Louis, had driven up to New York with a bunch of Firebirds. Ed sold Johnny his first Firebird.
Wow.
Right? And then Johnny wanted more. Right? So Ed drove up from St. Louis and brought, like, three Firebirds, and Johnny, you know, bought them all. And that was the first time I'd ever seen a big time guitar deal.
Right.
You know, I think
buy
they went
three Firebirds.
You know, they're $250 each.
Yes,
how about if I buy all three? $600 for all three. These were the glory days of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, Les was running around doing stuff.
You know, there were no vintage stores. You know, if I got something and I didn't really like it, I'd take it over to Paramount Pawn, which was Mr. Friedman's.
Right.
Pawn shop.
Over in Stuyvesant somewhere?
No, it was like over on 8th Avenue in the 40s.
Oh, right.
Right.
Didn't they have a Stuyvesant store?
Stuyvesant was Little Weebye.
Right.
Right. You could fit two customers in there and a billion guitars.
But it wasn't on 48th Street, was
it? It was on 48th
Street. Oh, it was?
Yeah. That's another of the, I guess, early 70s.
Right.
Because after, you know, buying and selling a couple of things with him, learned a lot about negotiating, you know, from
Mr.
P. He was the man, you know, and I would, you know, if I would buy stuff and I just, you know, sometimes just drive right into the city and turn it over.
I knew guys even from Pennsylvania.
Oh,
like,
yeah,
we said all
yeah,
we did was buy yeah, guitars around we were and drive into the city yeah, once a month and sell mm-hmm, it all to Richie Friedman, mm-hmm, and we were rich.
Mm-hmm.
We were buying Strats for like $50 and he would pay us like $80.
Yeah, you
know?
Yeah.
And we were
yeah,
rich. We yeah, were like, you know, my yeah, rent was yeah, $60. Yeah. You know, he's like, I just paid my rent for a year on driving around getting a bunch of guitars and driving to New York City. Because no one else could get real money except Friedman and those guys. You know, like, who could sell
well,
for top
then,
dollar?
That stuff was, I mean, I remember, like, the time I sold, I mean, I sold a Sunburst Strat to a musician for $800.
So you and I was like, holy fuck.
That's a lot of money. You know?
Yeah,
I bought one for $100 10 years ago.
Right.
You know, it's like, you just don't, you know, you began to see how, you know,
it was starting.
Old yeah, used guitars had started to turn into vintage guitars.
Well, yeah, the thing, I mean, even in the late 60s, early 70s, you could see people knew that the Les Pauls weren't the same.
Right.
They were buying old Les Pauls.
Right.
And everyone tells the story. It was around, it was like someone said, well, you paid more for a used guitar than
yeah,
the new version of it. Why the fuck would you do that?
Why would you do that?
And
yeah,
then it's like, well, they're not the same. Like, if
right,
I read an interview with Peter Green in 69,
mm-hmm,
where he was saying the new Les Pauls are not the same as the old ones. Buy the old ones.
Uh-huh.
He's like, or if you buy these new ones, they're okay, but you got to throw the pickups away. So
like,
they were hip to it immediately that they didn't sound the same.
When I saw Keith Richards with Les Paul, I went right to the music store and said, hey, I saw this guitar, you know, it's like, is it a kind of sunbursty finish? It was like a small version. And I remember Bill Bell, he worked at this place called Mascara Music, which was like the place in Belleville, New Jersey, you know, because he was a working musician. They knew a lot. He was also the guy who like, how do these guys bend these strings, right? And he went like, here's a banjo string.
Right. Oh, you did that thing?
Yeah.
Them all
said,
over?
He goes like, can you take your set of strings?
Are these the one, like the rock and roll strings? That
not
had?
Really.
He said those were the first
that,
ones.
That comes on, but this is early on. He
right,
goes like, you throw away the low E and you move,
and you
them
move
all
everything over.
Over.
Yeah,
and you put
me,
the banjo string on there and you're like, woo, woo. I'm like, I'm a god.
Oh, you really did that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Things you always hear that, oh, that's how they started.
There weren't nines. Yeah. Everything started at like 11 and up.
Right. And
know,
then someone, didn't Ernie Ball come out with
Ernie
rock and roll
strings or something? Ernie Ball was the slinky.
Right.
Right, which was the bit. I was like, I don't know, 66, something like that.
Right, and before that people would do
like
that.
I said, the dissemination of information was really,
right,
you learned from hearsay or you went to your
right,
music store.
Right.
And the
out,
older guys told you what the deal
right,
was.
Right. So I hung out in a music store when I was in college. There was a really great little vintage guitar shop a few towns over.
Mm-hmm.
And I just hung out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, yeah,
you
yeah,
would learn what you could learn. Eventually, they kind of gave me a job because
yeah,
I was, you know, mm-hmm, I would help them unpack the trucks, you know, and they would do set up some of my guitars for free.
Yeah.
You know, but I just would hang out there every day and just listen to those dudes because they would all play. And, like, that's how you sort of learn. You know, it wasn't always accurate, but, like, it was the best knowledge at the time, you know. But there was so much gear, you know, like
I
the
know,
one fellow who owned that shop, it was called the Bebop Shop in Liverpool, New York.
Wow.
Like, it was outside of Syracuse.
Uh-huh.
And the fella had so much stuff, he said, since the early 70s, he would just drive around that area and go to anything that said yard sale.
Right, I know.
And buying custom color Strats that were brand new, kid went off to the war and didn't come back. Like, he had so much stuff that wasn't even in the store, that in his own personal place.
Oh, we used to, there used to be this paper that came out, like every Wednesday, and it was all used stuff.
Right.
Right? And we would get that on Wednesday, and we'd go driving around.
Yeah.
Right? And then it was funny, because I bought a guitar from an elderly man, and when I took, you know, he asked for $100, I gave him $100, right? When I took the guitar home, I looked in the case, and there was this union book, right? And it was just interesting. I'd never seen one before. I'm paging through, right? And it had, you know, all the guys who played electric guitar, electric bass, which was not a lot.
Right.
Right? And
Fender bass probably.
Fender said, bass player, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so I was interested. So I was curious, right? They had phone numbers and stuff like that. So I would call them up. And they'd say, hey, is this? I go, is this Mr. So-and-so? I go, you know, I found this book. And it says you play electric guitar. You go, oh, not anymore. I go, do you still have your instrument?
Well, you did that.
Yeah.
I've heard of other people who did that.
Yeah.
They would
and,
buy those books.
Yeah, and I would, you know, and I go, if you do, you want to sell it? I'd be interested in buying it.
It's an 05.
Come over. Yeah, there were. Believe me, I made some stupid mistakes. You know,
those jazz guitars were hard to learn at first. You know
yeah, it was just like that's not for me.
I don't,
you know, I need one of these Les Paul things
yeah,
with a gold finish. You know,
but I know other people, like you hear people like became a genius, like they would look in the obituaries,
oh, yeah,
and then find and then call the widow and say, oh, I saw
yeah,
your husband play guitar. You
yeah,
know, they get the old union book. Do you still have his guitar?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, it's in the basement.
Yeah.
They'd run over there and, like,
mm-hmm,
you know, people were ingenious about that.
I bought
know,
bunches of guitars from you know, people who went to Vietnam.
Right, that's when, the fellow upstate said that there was a lot of that.
A lot of that.
Brand new guitars under the bed, and the parents didn't want to deal with it.
Uh-huh.
You know, and they're finally like, oh, yeah, I have the guitar under the bed, you know, I'll get rid of it. You know, like, you know what happened every once in a while at Chelsea, even? Someone would walk in with the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, every one time, like, you know, I was there with Danny, and some kid walks in, and he's like, oh, my grandfather gave me a guitar, and I want to learn how to play it. And we're like, oh, cool, let's check it out. We'll set it up for you. And he opens the case, and it's a 54 Strat. And it's new. And this kid must have been like 15, and Danny's going, do you have any idea what this is? And he started to like sweat. And the kid's like, no, it was my grandfather's. I just want to know how to play it. So Danny's like, well, it's worth quite a bit of money. I'll buy it from you. And he was like, no, it was my grandfather. Like, he's not having any of it. He's not selling it.
This is what I want.
So Danny's like, but this is a very, very valuable guitar. And he's like, it was his grandfather's.
I don't care. I need some money. I want to go to a bar.
Yeah, it was a little kid. He didn't care how much it was worth. He was playing this thing. It was so cool. He was just like, I don't care what color it was. It was my grandfather's. It could be worth $1 million.
So to continue on in the buy sell thing, right? That like that rehearsal place, I really got into. I met a lot of people,
sure.
Right? And I met Ed Seelig, right?
Well, that's where you got your name, right?
Yeah, and that's also where you know you began to realize that there was this subculture of old guitars, right? And then when I moved on to like Aerosmith and the New York Dolls, right? There were no vintage stores, right? But word got around that like you could that all these touring bands were always looking for old guitars, right?
Well, it was like Stephen Stills and those people.
Yeah, and all of them, you know. Yeah, and if you had an old guitar, you knew you could go down to the arena during the day and say, "I got an old guitar, I want to sell."
And the guitar player would come out and say, "What's going on?"
Or the backline guy, whatever, you come and take a look and say. Oh, big time. Like, big time.
There's a guy out here with guitars.
Huh?
There's a guy out here with guitars.
Yeah, there's a guy who wants to talk to you. He's got a couple of guitars to sell, and you go,
yeah, G told
bring
me,
him in.
Like, G. Smith told me, like, he just got a reputation as being a guy who bought old guitars.
Yeah.
And people would just come to the show and say, oh, I hear you buy things. And he's like, sure. And they would be flying these, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it was like we'd go play Houston, and, you know, Bart Whitrock, who would later open Rock and Robin Guitars,
right.
And Dave Wintz, his partner, who would later have Robin Guitars,
right.
They would come down, you know, with a bunch of cases, you know, and it was like, it's pretty affordable back then, I got to tell you, right? And the best one was Pete Alanoff, right, from St. Paul, Minnesota, because Pete had, like, you know, he knew how to have drama,
right?
He would show up in a 59 Cadillac convertible.
Oh, someone else, right? Yeah, you tell me someone else.
With a couple of girls to carry the guitars,
nice.
Right? And he'd come with like 8 Les Pauls, you know, a flying V.
Yeah, brown,
you know,
cases as far as
and he would, you know, I mean, I bought a 55 Esquire from him for $500.
Yes.
Right? And you had to promise that when you sell it, you had to sell it back to him. Right?
All those guys used to do
it. Yeah, it's enough. If you're going to sell, you call me up, and I'll give you your $500 back.
Right.
You know, it
sounds like the Wild West and like that.
It was.
Because when I came over, it was the 80s. It was still the Wild West compared to what came
right,
later.
Right, but I mean,
but not
like,
nearly as cool as it was in
the 70s.
Things had
started to accelerate.
Right.
You know? I mean, like, my first burst cost me $350.
Wow.
Right, and I bought a gold top from Rondo Music for $275 with a Bigsby.
Early 70s.
Early 70s, late 60s, early 70s. And the burst is a funny story because I was in Music Inn,
right?
You know, in the West Village.
It's still there,
right?
Right? We
it's
talked
still there.
About that in the last podcast.
Still there, right? You know,
he
and
charged
they,
$1 to go in.
Yeah, he tried it. So I go, I think we wanted to, you know, me and his buddy Mike, we wanted to buy
it. Did the New York Dolls go there and, like, have some kind of thing where they
No, they were totally locked into Friedman.
Oh, did they? That's where they bought the guitars? Someone told me they used to go there and they had some scam at the Music Inn. I don't know if it was true.
No, the scam, let me tell you, the scam of the New York Dolls was what they would do. They were big on pawn shops. Right, and when they needed money, what they would do is they knew there were shows coming up, they would pawn their guitars, right, for like $50, right, and then they would take the receipt and add. They knew how to do this, you know, add a zero,
and they go to the manager.
They go to the manager. I go. We got shows this weekend. He goes, yeah, you're going to L.A. He goes, I had to pawn my guitar. I have nothing to play. And they go,
How much?
How much? You know, and you show him the receipt for $500. And you go like, he goes, you're not paying us enough to live. You know, say, give him the $500.
Does he get the guitar back at $450?
And the pawn shops loved it because it's usually, you know, it was usually like a 5-day turnaround. Here's your money. Yeah. Here's the, you know, here's the percentage.
Yeah, beautiful.
And that thing in the window, how much you want for that?
Yeah, give us more guitars. Right? More guitars. Give us a white Falcon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know.
Those guys were geniuses on that level.
They were street kids. They really, there were some hustling going on, let me tell you. I learned a lot about how the hustle on them, too. But as we travel around and you'd see stuff, you know. You'd buy, they were always buying things.
Oh, yeah, we see pictures of them. They're the coolest shit.
Yeah, juniors, I remember when, Falcons. When Johnny went up and bought, like, ES-275, the gold, like...
$295,
right? And he bought, he goes, this look, you know, like all the rockabilly guys play this. So he plugs that into a Marshall stack.
Yeah. Get rid of this thing.
That went back the next day,
But that happened to all of us when we were kids. We'd get those big guitars. We're like, these are awesome. And you'll plug it in and hit your tube screen.
You're going,
it's like, look what the fuck!
Where are those t-shirts?
Yeah, and then it was, well, Ted Nugent put socks in it. Like, someone go get me some socks! You know, like, what? And then I get socks stuck in my guitar.
So, you know, so, after a period of time, you know, you begin to know what's good, what's not, what's popular, whatever, you know, and, you know, the interesting thing, and these days are gone forever, is that the price of an instrument was based on what people in your locale would pay.
Right. Well, it was very regional back then. Yeah.
It was totally regional. You know, somebody would buy something for $75 and be happy to sell it for $100.
Right.
Because it was a quick turnover, right?
Well, that's what NAMM was back then. It's like people would go and say, oh, I can get these guitars in my store. You'd get a line of guitars.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And you'd sell them and you'd see what price you can get on them. And that's really like, because it's Robbie's Music over here near me. And you told me that was there in the 50s or
60s. No, not the 50s. It was in the 60s.
And they were a Fender dealer.
There was a Robbie's on Broad Street in Newark.
Right, that's a different Robbie's though, right?
Same guy.
Oh, is that right?
Same family.
That's why I'd heard that there were many of these.
Yeah, the same family. And there's another one on 46, too.
Right.
And the interesting thing about that is I don't know whether they owned the building or they got like an insane 50-year lease or something like that. Because after you did some business, right, you know, he would say, you know, I got this stuff upstairs.
Yeah, but they say there's still stuff up there, right?
Yeah, well, it's I don't think that place is gone.
You know, but there's the big one over here that looks like a barn.
Yeah, we should go over there one day.
And it's weird. You know, it's mostly looks like a kind of guitar center. There's no old things.
No, well, that's no good then. There's no reason to go there. They used to have a lot of Orange amps.
Yeah, that's what you said. They were an Orange dealer.
They had a lot of. I went there once, and there were a ton of Orange amps, most of which are now at Chicago Music Exchange.
Right.
Because they had like some flood thing, and the grill cloths were all discolored on the bottom.
Right.
When I went to Chicago Music Exchange, they go, "I know where you got those." Yeah.
So then. Why don't we talk about how you then got into, because we know how, you know, everyone knows you did sound for all these big bands.
So here's the thing, right, that in, when you're a touring band, right, these guitars take a beating.
We hope you enjoyed part one of our podcast with Nightbot. To hear part two, please tune in next week.